All right, well, hello there, TSFers. We're here for our first podcast of the year. We're a little late here, week two of the Australian Open, but I've got David Thorpe with me, fresh and tan from Puerto Rico. How are you, David?
I'm good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Were you playing any tennis down in Puerto Rico?
I played a lot of Kadima.
What's that?
That's that paddle game on the beach that people play.
Is that beach tennis?
No. Beach tennis is like, there's a net and rackets, but that's basically paddle
Kadima.
Tennis. Kadima. It means forward in Hebrew.
Oh.
You see people all over the... I'm surprised you don't know it.
Playing... So there's no net.
There's no net. There's no score. It's just a friendly game of back and forth ping pong.
Okay.
Basically, and it's a great substitute for tennis. And you can also hit the ball really hard and try to ding your opponent.
I feel like Svetlana Kuznetsova would love that game. No scores, no pressure. She can just play the game. It would be fine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All right, so we've got a few topics that we're going to talk about Australian Open related and go through. So let's kind of jump in, which I feel like the most newsy of them would be Justine's retirement.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of coming out of nowhere. And Dave and I were talking before the podcast. She makes this decision, you know, about a week after or less than her third round loss to Sveta. And so just kind of, you know, strange sort of quick knee-jerk reaction there, I felt. But what did you feel about the retirement and now she's supposedly gone for good?
Well, I think she is being a bit of a drama queen. You know, there was nothing so urgent about the retirement announcement that she couldn't have made it after the Australian Open was over, and it seems she's stealing a little bit of the spotlight from the players who are still in the tournament. So maybe Justine has like a secret sort of craving for the spotlight that we actually hadn't seen before. Although she did do that weird
like
charity
Belgian
dance
Idol
TV thing when she was horrifically bad.
Big time.
Yeah. So maybe she's just not getting the attention she needs.
Well, I think that it's... To me, it's not that surprising the way that she went about it. I just feel like she has always been this person who's prided herself on, you know, being sort of a workhorse and all these, you know, different sort of, I keep my chin to my chest and this is who I am. But there was always a little bit about her that I felt like, wait, you, what? You know, and I definitely felt like I saw that at the 2003 French Open when the whole hand incident with Serena and her just kind of shrugging her shoulders at the whole issue. And so, I mean, I think she's a great competitor. We got a chance to talk to her at the US Open last year for TSF, and she was so nice and so energetic, and I was pretty surprised at how personable she was. But I don't know. I mean, I think if the elbow problem is that much, it's lingering. It, you know, it sounds like she's dealt with it literally for the last 6 months and she just can't shake it. But it seems like it's going to be a little bit like, are we going to hear from her in 6 months or 2 years? Or why not just take a break at this point? You know what I mean?
Yeah, give yourself a little time to make a decision when you are on a, you know, less emotional footing. But I think it'd be great if she came back again. I mean,
do you really?
Well, bring on the drama. I love the retirement, the unretirement.
The WTA would love that too.
Yeah, it keeps it fresh. And I mean, there's sort of like, how many times can you do that? And each time it gets a little more pathetic. And, you know, we do need clowns.
Yeah, well, but as you were saying, I actually totally agree. Mary Pierce and Jennifer Capriati, if you're listening. But her game is so different, as you were saying before the podcast, that we would love to have her different style out there, too.
It's true. That's the fundamental thing that, that we'll all really miss.
Right.
But someday, somewhere, there's some WTA player out there that will bring the excitement again, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, definitely. I mean, I hope so. Right?
Yeah. This fallow period has been going on for quite a while, I think.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, like, I love Li Na, who's our next topic, but I don't think anybody's, like, going to be passionate about her game.
Why is that?
Because she's, I have only seen her play a couple times, but she just pounds the ball from the baseline.
Yeah.
I don't know. Correct me if I'm wrong. And so, you know, that's great and exciting to watch when it works, but it's not artistry. It's not compelling, I don't think.
Yeah.
It's more work.
She's a little, I mean, I guess I haven't watched her play a ton, but I think that you're right in the sense that she's kind of one of those crop of players like Azarenka, who has come up and, you know, kind of made herself known in the upper echelon of the game, but not necessarily distinguished herself. I think Kim is so distinguishable with her flexibility and her speed, and the Williams sisters with their, you know, ferocity and just kind of the way that they upped what Seles and Graf were doing in the sense of, you know, really hitting the ball that hard. But now I think you're right. We're kind of at this point, especially with the women, that it's like, where are they going to go with the game itself? And seeing someone like Dementieva retire, you know, this last fall, and now Justine, it's a little like the game, where does the artistry go? Not that Dementieva was an artist in really any sense, but the big babe tennis is kind of like, you know, the ripple effect of the rock in the lake. It's getting a little monotonous, I think.
I agree. But maybe, who knows, maybe Chinese tennis will save us.
That's so what are your predictions for this weekend with Lina and Clayton?
I predict a tidal wave of Chinese players will take over the WTA, and you will rarely see a European face in the top 100.
I mean,
isn't that what's being said between the lines in all of these articles about
Lina?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, it's like a metaphor for sort of Chinese
takeover.
Global domination.
Just like the Eastern Europeans had kind of taken over, and, you know, the Russian wave in the early 2000s.
Exactly. But in this case, the economic power of the Chinese is dovetailing with, you know, the the emerging
the
tennis
rise.
Power. So,
okay, got it.
Yeah.
We'll check back in on that in March, maybe. Okay. Right. What about, while we're on the subject, what about Sharapova? Do you think she's done? Is she ever going to win a slam again?
I hope she's done.
Really?
I hate her.
It's just so interesting. I mean, she could not have looked worse against Petkovic. I mean, just, you know, it was like, wait, have won majors?
But she looked pretty sleepy against Julia Gorgas.
Really?
Gorgas or whatever as well. Like, the first set of that match, she was like a wall or something. MIA?
I don't know.
I mean, she's, you know, it's funny because, like, she struggles with injuries now, and she's always been such, like, a diva and kind of a biatch, and so you don't really have that much sympathy for her. And
right.
I'm sorry, maybe I'm crotchety and old, but I find the shrieking to be really off-putting. I agree with Martina Navratilova that she's cheating, and, you know, it's like, really, you need to shriek like that on a drop shot, and, you know. Anyway, so I say good riddance.
Okay.
Let's do something new.
All right. Well, moving on, we were talking a little bit about the scheduling, especially on the men's side, because you've got Djokovic, who's already into the final. He will have 2.5 days, actually, because the men's final at the Aussie is played at night. And so now you have Murray and Ferrer playing tomorrow, and they don't really have that advantage. You know, if they have a long 5-set match, it's really hard to do. And I think that discussion has kind of been brought up as well at the US Open, in the sense that, you know, these guys have to go out, and whoever's playing the later match on Super Saturday, well, if they play until, you know, 5-6 in the evening, they have a, what is that, you know, 20-hour turnaround to the next day. And so, I don't know, what are your thoughts specifically at the Aussie and the scheduling that they have set up there?
I think it's a shame that in the final two rounds of the Australian Open that they give such an advantage to one player, in this case Djokovic, who's come through so early and has so much time to rest. I understand that because of scheduling, some players are going to have to play back-to-back, but I think it's less of advantage or disadvantage when it's from the round of 16 to the quarters.
Yeah, agreed. Or even the quarters.
Or even the quarters to the semis. Yeah, but at this point, I mean, this is the pressure does just not get any bigger than this, and especially with, you know, Murray sort of probably licking his chops at the chance of no Federer, no Nadal. So, I think it's kind of a mistake, and also it kills the momentum of the tournament.
We didn't mention this before we decided to before we were talking about our notes, but it is, you know, if you've ever been to a major and you've been there on the second week, it is kind of a weird feeling because there's a lot of junior matches going on. There's, you know, good tennis to be watched, but, you know, 95% of the players are gone. And for Friday to have only one marquee match, I think, I'm guessing that there's a big doubles marquee match as well. I don't know the exact schedule, but It is strange to, on a Friday, to only have that. Whereas at the U.S. Open, you've got the women's stuff happening, and then the men's semis haven't even began. And so I guess I'm curious, you know, for someone in Melbourne or who has been there and experienced that, it does seem like it seems to cut a, you know, one of the main arteries of the tournament. It's like, all right, well, I guess we'll have finals weekend in a couple days. You know what I mean?
Exactly. So do you think Ferrer has any chance?
I do, yeah. I mean, I think that Ferrer matches up pretty well against Murray. They're both somewhat of, you know, a, I'll get everything back to you sort of player. I think Murray, it's Murray's match to win or lose. And I know that that saying can carry different weights, but it really is. And, you know, all the British press that flew down last year because it was Murray's year to win the Aussie. Well, this is his year to win the Aussie too. So I just think that he's got to arrive and show up. And then I think it's a toss-up if he gets into the final against Djokovic. I would love to see that, though, more than a Ferrer-Djokovic final.
What yeah, yeah. Well, I would like to see a Murray-Djokovic final, and I actually think that's in some ways like a kind of critical game for both of them because they are really the sort of the pretenders to the top, and
sure.
Djokovic has managed to stay slightly in front of Murray by having won the Australian in 2008. And also, I just think at the top of his game that Djokovic is more dangerous, that when he is playing freely and with confidence, he hits the ball so big
right.
that I don't think many people have much of a chance against him. And if he, you know, if he can not let all sort of the tricks and the tactics and the variety from Murray get to him, I don't think Murray has much of a chance. And it was a little bit like Del Potro and Federer or mm-hmm. Djokovic and Federer sometimes. And unfortunately for those of us who love artistry and variety, if a big bruiser swings freely from both sides, he usually wins.
Yeah, that's true.
So, yeah, but it's exciting. And I'm ready for a changing of the guard, I'll admit that.
It is a little bit, and I'm interested in what you said a couple minutes ago, that it's a big match for both of them. Do you think it's a bigger match for one or the other in the sense that Djokovic has already a major to his name?
I think it's probably about the same because, you know, Murray, it will sort of maintain the status quo if Djokovic wins, but like a slightly more exaggerated status quo. You know, Murray will still be without a slam. Djokovic will still have a couple slams to his name, and I think it'll widen the gulf of the status quo somewhat, but I think, gosh, now I feel like I just contradicted what
well,
I said.
Well, I think
confused.
For
what
me,
am I, talking about?
I think that...
I think it's a big, big match for
I think it's
two.
A bigger match for Murray, for me, because he doesn't win this, and then he's kind of like, I don't know, I mean, I could see him losing this match and then us seeing a slump from him for the rest of the year, and not that that's what's going to happen, but for him, I think it is a bigger deal than for Djokovic.
And it would be really great for him to win, because then you'd have four guys at the top who've all won Grand
Slams,
and there would be real parity in the field. And
sure.
Murray's such an exciting and fun player that it would be great if he could get in touch with sort of his champion's confidence and win some slams.
Totally.
And poor, you know, poor old Mother England.
Yeah, they're ready for it. So before we sign off, there's obviously a lot that happened. We did our Sunday survey last week of the wackiest moment of week one, which a lot of people were saying the dead spot, high sense, Radwanska's racket breaking. But what about for you? What was the wackiest moment?
Well, I
or
think
your
the
favorite moment. It doesn't have to be
I
wacky.
Think it was actually possibly during that Radwanska Date Krum match where they cut to Pam doing some on-court commentary.
Pam.
And she was wearing one of the worst outfits I've ever seen a tennis commentator, bar none, where it was like sleeveless, safari-inspired, sun hat. She just looked like a crazy old lady.
I wonder if she just came from Oprah's Australian experience.
Maybe she did. Maybe she did. But it seems like a lot of the women commentators feel obliged to wear these incredibly ugly sun hats.
Yeah.
And I think really just for the moment you're on camera, perhaps take off your hat or put a baseball cap on.
Right.
It's a tennis event. Put a visor on. But I think the fashion overall has been a huge debacle for both the men's and the women's tour. Of course, with Venus having really led the way with her pie top.
Those tops were something else. I think my favorite moment was actually another fashion moment of Bethany Maddox Sams wearing her, like, black and white. She had a black and white number on. I think it was a dress. It might have been a skirt and top. But then she did the football player black under her eyes.
Nice. I didn't see that.
Which, Bethany makes some frightening choices. I don't know if you saw at the Hotman Cup, she had these, like, literally, like, leggings on, you know, spandex pants that were kind of, like, fluorescent and puzzle piece. Very 80s. But I enjoyed the stripes and sort of like a referee slash football player happening.
I love her. I think she has good style. I think even, you know, so she has a few missteps, but she's having a great time. Not everyone can be Venus and Serena. Right. She's got to get pleasure and satisfaction out of life in more ways than just her tennis, which doesn't seem is ever.
Well, she's great. She does a blog for the USA Today and for their website, and she is with it and very thoughtful. And she seems like a good person to be out there.
I say, keep it up, BMS. Bring it.
Oh, all right. Well, that's all the BMS time we have and all the AO time we have on TSF. David Thorpe, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
And we'll check in with you guys hopefully soon following the AO and come back to TSF for all of your fashion, culture, and arts needs in the tennis world. Thanks a lot.